This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support, so if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Jo Reed, who is the last one-third of the Three Mums, One Mission, ARFID podcast. Together, we speak about her experience of supporting her daughter Ethel with her ARFID diagnosis, and we particularly talk about the sensory sensitivities that Ethel has that has made her particularly susceptible and to having a real anxiety around food. We talk about the impact of family life of having a child with ARFID and how this can mean that planning it can be so difficult when going out for days out. We finally talk about the things that friends and family can do to support somebody when they're navigating supporting a loved one with ARFID. If you're supporting someone right now, please know that you're not alone. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Jo Reed, who is the third mum that we have recorded with from the Three Mums, One Mission podcast. So it's very lovely to have you on, Jo.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no, it's been, I'm very glad that we did it this way of recording with you all together and now got to know you all a bit better and heard your story. So I don't think that the first episode we did covered enough detail at all, so it's been really nice to chat with you all.
Yeah, exactly that. We always have so much to say.
Yes, and absolutely, as you should. Just in case people haven't listened to the first episode with you, did you want to introduce yourself?
So my name's Jo. I have a daughter called Ethel. She is 6 years old now. She is diagnosed with ARFID and was diagnosed in August 2024. So she had just turned five when she got the diagnosis. In fact, actually, it was like 2 days before her fifth birthday. And then we were sort of transferred over to CAMHS from that point, because in our area, I think, well, every area does their own thing slightly differently, but in our area you couldn't refer to CAMHS until the child turned five. So that was the next step for us. So it took a while to get a diagnosis. Ethel was always funny with food, and obviously being a second time mum, even though, you know, people say, oh, don't compare, but obviously you are going to compare to your older child, kind of. You think you've got a bit of an idea as to what you might be doing, even though there's an 8-year age gap between my older daughter and Ethel. So obviously, like, the guidelines have changed for things with regard to weaning, you know, even things like how you make a bottle and stuff like that. So obviously you're still, as a parent, constantly reading up on things. So we did the whole, like, sort of baby-led, bit of baby-led weaning, bit of purees, always sort of mixed and blended up a bit of what we were having where appropriate. She liked strong tastes, which was always quite strange. So she would always really favour things like a curry sauce type flavouring. So we would make, obviously, homemade curries and things like that, and she would always like the sauce that was, I mean, it wasn't blow your head off or anything like that, but, you know, quite a strong taste. And things like Twiglets and Marmite, she always really liked strong flavours. So we just realised that she would find sort of certain textures quite tricky. Meat, she was always found really difficult. So even though we would chop it up very small, things like egg, cheese, anything that sort of had a really sort of sloppy, wet kind of texture to it, she would really struggle with. Obviously, we persevered and tried all the different techniques that, you know, are recommended by the NHS, by health visitors. And it was always like, you know, just keep offering the foods. If she doesn't eat one day, she might eat the next day. Maybe do like a buffet style. Maybe do this. Maybe try that. So again, we tried it all. And it just got to the point where she got to about 18 months old. And I was like, she doesn't really eat anything hot, like nothing cooked. She just lives off of dry, crunchy, like crackers, breadsticks, rice cakes, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, people would say to me, oh, it's okay. She'll let you know when she's ready for food. She'll let you know when she's hungry and she's not going to waste away. I was like, yeah, but this problem seems to be getting worse rather than better. Like nothing is, you know, every mealtime we'd be like, oh, maybe this might be the time that she'll eat something that's cooked. And it just never happened. And, you know, time went on and I would take her to the GP. We got referred to several, sort of passed from pillar to post to different places, being the nursing team through the health visitor, dietitian, and then eventually we were passed on to a paediatrician who saw her in like sort of 6 monthly reviews. And again, she was very focused on the whole BMI, the fact that her weight was good, the fact that she was growing and that she was obviously getting taller and heavier every time she saw her, which, you know, don't get me wrong, is great. But I, you know, kept saying, but she doesn't, the things that she's eating has nothing of any nutrition in it. So yeah, it was a lot of back and forward. She started preschool, and she caught everything going. You know, she was just always quite a sickly child. It still is, you know, catches every cold, cough, virus, sickness, bug. Just because, and I purely and simply always say it, I think it's because, you know, the nutrition's not there. So yeah, it was just a battle to try and get any support from anybody.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point that you say about the focus on BMI, because I think of a lot of the people that I've spoken to, but I guess part of their offered is that they are malnourished and that they're at a low weight. But, you know, that's only one part of the diagnostic criteria. Yeah. And I guess it's a similar situation to like anorexia. There's such a focus on weight and not looking holistically at the bigger picture in terms of what somebody's actually eating, the impact that that's having on them, and different things like that. Because ultimately, you know, and I think I remember when I did my nutrition master's, there was an article that came out and it was like the first time I'd heard about ARFID, and it was talking about a little boy who only ate crisps, and I think he'd lost his vision through only eating crisps, but he was at a quote unquote healthy BMI. And it's like, well, it doesn't matter what your BMI is, if you're not getting the nutrients that you need to thrive, surely that should be the focus.
Yeah, absolutely that. And I always said, you know, the things that she does eat are obviously quite high in calories. So, you know, she was eating a lot of carbs. I was like, that, I think that's the only way that she's getting through is by eating the carbohydrate side of things, like the breadsticks, the rice cakes, the crackers, the pretzels, and milk. She still had milk. So again, we were we were told, you know, cut down the milk, which we did. And she religiously only had a very small amount of milk in the morning when she first got up and just before bed as like a sort of settling bedtime.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The Real Real.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The Real Real? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The Real Real than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The Real Real. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
And even then, when we reduced the milk so much, I was like, it's not making, she didn't eat anymore. She still just would pick at things. And, you know, the things that I've done in the past that I'm ashamed of through things that have been said to me, try this, try that, sort of starving her, cutting out things that she, you know, that she does eat. I remember a pediatrician said to me, we could just stop giving her chicken nuggets, because that's the only hot, and still is now the only hot cooked piece of protein that she will eat is a chicken nugget. She said, you could just stop giving them to her. And I said, well, I can't, because if I don't give her those, she will be hungry. She will just go hungry. I can't just swap it out for a fish finger, you know. It just doesn't work like that. And I think that's where the frustration for a lot of parents of children with ARFID is that it's just dismissed as, oh, well, just stop giving it to them and then they'll eat a fish finger, or then they'll eat a sausage instead. You know, it just does not work like that. If it was that easy, it wouldn't exist, would it? So I think that's the hardest part to deal with sometimes, is the frustration with the system. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's no magic wand. No one can just, you know, make your child eat, but just to have that little bit more understanding and not to just kind of fob you off as making you feel like you're a bad parent because you've done something wrong and not weaned your child properly. Because, you know, hand on heart, I can honestly say I've tried everything, and as I said before, I'm ashamed of some of the things when I look back, and I was really strict with her at times and said, this is what you're having. And it was the same meal as what her sister was having. If you do not eat it, then that is it. There's nothing else. And that would be it. She just wouldn't eat. I've got videos. I used to set up a camera to show the pediatrician that I was trying everything. And there's videos of her pretending to eat the food because she knew that that's what I wanted her to do. She's literally pretending at 3.5 years old to nibble some chips. So yeah, and going back to the whole, you know, sort of not helping people when their BMI is fine and everything, just because their BMI is fine does not mean they don't have a mental block when it comes to eating, not eating, or, you know, sensory aversions and things like that. You know, it's much more than just jumping on some scales and seeing how much you've grown.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's something that I quite often hear when I speak to people about ARFID, in terms of, you know, the food groups that feel safer for individuals mm-hmm. to eat. And I wondered if maybe you'd be okay in sharing a bit of Ethel's experience, just, I guess, to kind of explain why certain foods for her feel manageable and why others, you know, because if I think often when you look at it, it does tend to be like, if it's okay to say, like the more beige foods that feel more safe, but then things like fruits and vegetables and meat and, you know, dairy, like you've said, are just, it seems like a common thing that happens to people. I'm not saying that's gonna be everyone's experience. I wondered if you had any, you know, thoughts around why that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've found that exactly that. So, you know, branded things, For example, at the moment, well, for a long, long time, Ethel will only eat a McDonald's chicken nugget, and it has to be a McDonald's nugget. And if it's from anywhere else, she can tell. I have tried cooking them. I have tried cooking them and putting them in a McDonald's bag to eat, a chicken nugget bag to make it look like I've been bought them from McDonald's. And she'll say things to me like, I can smell the oven on them. So it's almost like she can smell the cooking process. She can smell that they're different. They're not the same. She can tell 100%. I have tried every dupe that you can get, because obviously people will say, oh, have you tried these ones? Have you tried the Aldi ones? Have you tried the Asda ones? Have you tried this? I've tried them all. There's no fobbing her off. She can tell. Even like the type of crisp that she has, if we were to buy a different brand, she can tell that they are different. Even though you don't show her the packet, you pour them into a bowl, she can tell. Like, she's got super senses. But yeah, with regards to sort of like the beige food, obviously a McDonald's chicken nugget is the same every time. So that's often why things like McDonald's fries and McDonald's chicken nuggets are often a safe food for children and adults with ARFID. For example, if you have like a strawberry, sometimes it might be really firm, sometimes it might be really squishy, might be really juicy, might be really sweet, might be really bitter, might be really sour. It's never consistent, so it will always be different. Whereas the beige food, a cracker is always a cracker. A rice cake is always a rice cake. There's no, you know, it's reliable, I guess. It's that same thing. Like, we're very lucky. Ethel will eat an apple occasionally, but again, they have to be pink lady apples, because again, I think she really does like that crunch. So if they've gone slightly soft or anything like that, and a raw carrot, which again, she will eat it, but she has to eat it whole. So I just peel it. And again, I guess with a raw carrot, unless you've obviously left them in your fridge for months on end, they're always really firm and crunchy, aren't they? They kind of, a carrot is quite consistent. So yeah, it's been explained to us before by a play therapist, and even just when you're chewing something, obviously that first initial bite, it could be quite crunchy, but then the longer you chew it in your mouth, the texture changes. Sometimes the flavour will change, because we used to find she would be fine and then it would hit the back of her throat and she would gag and spit out whatever it was that she was eating. And the play therapist said, yeah, that's, you know, it's quite common that it's obviously changing its consistency, and the longer you chew it, it's changing, and it's not necessarily what they expect to be swallowing, and it's changed too much. So it's a massive learning curve, and obviously we've had to learn along the way, because we love food as a family. Like, we are big foodies, and you know, when a lot of your social life revolves around food and going out for dinner and meeting up with friends and eating. So to then have a child that really does struggle with food, you know, it's a huge, huge like spanner in the works. It's kind of like, you know, we have to do things slightly differently now, and, you know, tread a bit more carefully around certain things.
Yeah. And, you know, from what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like that relationship with food is, I guess, taste has come into it, because taste is obviously a sense, but it feels like it's more those foods are safe because they don't provide anxiety, because ultimately, you know, they tend to be the same each time. And I've never even, you know, considered that in terms of the fact of, if I put a cracker in my mouth, when I first put it in my mouth, it's hard. And then as you chew it, it goes soft. So, you know, I think for somebody that is very sensitive to those changes, it doesn't make sense, as in it shouldn't be like that, but it makes sense as to why the process of eating becomes something that you just don't want to engage in, because there's so much happening there.
Yeah, exactly that. And when you sit and think about it, having a meal, sitting down and eating a packed lunch or whatever, it's such a huge sensory experience. Obviously, you've got the sounds, you might be able to hear someone chewing next to you, you might be able to smell someone else's lunch that's not necessarily pleasant. The textures, the fact that somebody else might have, you know, knocked something over and then it might spill near your lunch, you know, it's such a massive thing. And I think we often forget that, you know, for some people, it's quite easy to just sit and gobble down a sandwich and that's it, lunch is done. But for others, it's such a sensory overload, especially for one, children and adults with ARFID, neurodivergent people, but as well, neurotypical people. You know, some people would genuinely really struggle with that. So yeah, it's a, you know, it's a massive, massive thing.
Yeah. And I guess just going back to what you were saying about like the impact that it's had on your family, because that must be such a difficult pull between if you're foodies and like you say, even if you're not necessarily a foodie, like I know from my eating disorder experience, my world has opened up now that I can go and have food and not have all those worries and concerns beforehand. Because even if you try and put yourself in that situation, it's still then in the moment. As you said, it's a massive sensory experience. There's so much going on. But I imagine that was quite challenging, that push and pull between, you know, wanting to go out and socialise, yeah, and do the things that you enjoy, but also seeing how much distress that was causing for Ethel.
Yeah, it is. It's huge. And, you know, it's things like just days out. You can't just go and sit down in a restaurant and order something. You can't just go and grab something from the cafe or whatever. So it's all that forward thinking and forward planning. And thinking, is it going to be too smelly? Will she cope being in this place? We recently went to Disneyland Paris and she barely ate anything while we were there. Even though I took all of her safe foods, she was not interested in eating anything whilst there, which obviously then has a knock-on effect because obviously it affects her mood, affects her energy levels. And obviously it's such a hectic, busy place. You want to be, you know, going and doing everything. And we ended up actually having to hire a pushchair because she was just so exhausted because she had zero energy from the lack of food. So, you know, like I say, yeah, you can't just nip in and grab something. I mean, my dream is to be able to just go somewhere and order something from a menu, to give her the children's menu and just say, order something. You know, I'd pay thousands, you know, just to be able to have that. It sounds silly, but, you know, just to be able to have that moment that we could just pop in somewhere. Because obviously there's nothing on the menu that she will eat, not even chips, you know. Oh, if she ate chips, it would be so much easier. Because then at least we could order chips when we go somewhere. But we just have to, like I say, we just have to forward plan everything and sort of pre-warn her as to where we're going, what we're doing. She has got better at tolerating sort of sitting with us whilst we're eating. She would quite often just take herself off and like sit further away from us. You know, it's a hard one because obviously you don't want your life to stop either. Like as I said before, we've got an older daughter who also enjoys all the same things that we do. So it's kind of like you've got to get that balance right, that you're still, you know, doing things that you enjoy that are not too distressing for Ethel as well. So it's a bit of a fine line, but yeah. I think we somehow manage it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the things I often say when people say, you know, what are your top tips for families? And I say, you know, try as much as you possibly can to do things for yourself, because you can't pour from an empty cup. And especially if there's another child in the household, it's, you know, you don't want to be limiting her life, but equally then not kind of distressing, yeah, your other child. And I think when I spoke to Michelle and Sarah, we spoke a bit about kind of advice that you'd give to other parents. But from what you were saying just then, I was thinking something that could be interesting is, in those social situations, have there been helpful or unhelpful things that people maybe outside of, you know, your close family, that they've said or done that have been, as I say, both helpful and unhelpful?
Yes. I mean, there is quite a lot of unhelpful comments that float around. And I think the hardest thing is constantly having to explain Ethel's eating habits. And then you kind of, especially in friendship groups, and so they'll then sort of compare their own children and say, well, you know, my so-and-so only has sausage and mash, pizza, pasta, fish fingers and chips. I'm like, yeah, that's you know, that's not the same. You've just listed four meals there. If only she ate one of those meals, like, I would be jumping for joy. So I think it's a tricky one, because I don't think there's many helpful comments that I can really think of.
Maybe what you think people could do to be helpful might be, I mean, we're laughing, but, you know, that is an awful reality, thinking about it with the whole weaning and things like that, in terms of, until you have a child, you're not taught how to wean. And then when you have a child, you know, you're giving the information and the advice. But yeah, imagine that is a terrifying thing to go through as a parent. Like, am I doing this right? You know, how should they be responding? Blah, blah, blah. But then it feels like everybody then becomes an expert on it. And everybody becomes an expert on how to feed your child. And that judgment of, well, clearly you're just, I mean, I remember you saying before in the episode, I'm sure they'll eat sweets. Or, like, you know, do they only eat sweets? And it's this connotation of, you know, bad parenting because they're eating quote unquote unhealthy food. But actually, surely, whether it is deemed as unhealthy or not, getting something in them is surely better than nothing. But people don't seem to have that kind of understanding.
And it is hard. And again, going back to the whole sweet situation, you know, like, we've got Easter coming up. There's no way she would eat an Easter egg, because to her, like, that's not a pleasant thing to eat. So, you know, it's not that she's just being picky and wants all the rubbish food. It is the fact that the top and bottom of it is she is frightened of food and trying new foods and smells. And, you know, she can't even bring herself to touch cooked pasta. We do lots of sensory play and playing with food and cooking and things like that. She doesn't like the mixture getting on her hands. She will, like, sort of hold the spoon like this because she doesn't want to touch it. So it's a huge sensory experience for her. Going back to the social situations, I think it's just the best thing you can do is, like, find your tribe as such. And we have got a lot of friends that are very understanding, you know, and always say, you know, we're always apologising, saying, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, that she's not going to sit at the table. They're like, it's fine, it doesn't matter. And that, or they might say, what can we get in for her? And I'm like, nothing. I'll bring some foods for her. So yeah, I think it is just about finding your people, because some people are just never going to get it, unfortunately, and are always going to have that judgy way of mind, you know, the sort of typical back in my day, if you didn't eat it, you just went to bed hungry. I'm sorry, but I don't want my child to go to bed hungry. And also, if she's hungry, she's not going to go to sleep. You know, if that means driving to get some chicken nuggets so that she's got a full tummy and go to bed happy, go to sleep and wake up and manage a day at school the next day, then, you know, what are you going to do? Because I have tried, and I, at this point in our lives, there's no other alternative. So, you know, that's just the way it is at the moment.
And I mean, you know what, I think from the way that you're talking, and also if there was another option, you probably wouldn't have started a podcast and be going to Parliament to raise awareness and, you know, fighting with clinicians and healthcare professionals to get the support that you need. And I mean, I know that ARFID isn't necessarily something that is only experienced by people with neurodiversity, but what you were saying about, like, finding your tribe, since getting my diagnosis, I feel like I've sort of had the same mentality there, in that some people will appreciate that if I'm absolutely burnt to a crisp, I can be present, but I need to be lying on the floor with all my teddies around me and loads of soft blankets. Other people don't understand that. And it's been a learning curve for me, in the sense of, sometimes I might, you know, have the energy to hang out with those people that maybe don't understand those needs as much. But it's actually okay to also not want to spend time with those people. Yeah. And as you said, to be able to find your tribe of people that understand, because that takes off so much of the pressure and so much of the exhaustion associated with this kind of thing. I think a lot of the time is, you know, trying to hide what's going on, or trying to justify what's going on, or being worried about what people are going to say. So, you know, the fact that you have got friends that understand and try and support in their own little way, I think I've taken a very similar approach with my neurodiversity, and it's so much more refreshing.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a lot to take on, and it's a lot to understand and get your head around. And I'm not ashamed to admit I've had to have help with my mental health because of the anxiety of, you know, my child not eating and having to take so much time off work to be able to care for her and look after her and go to hospital appointments and all of that kind of thing. You know, there's been some really dark times where I've felt very alone and not knowing what to do or where to go next. And so, yeah, finding those people, i.e. Michelle and Sarah, a few others along the way, you know, it's just so nice to be able to chat to them. I mean, I started my Instagram page out of sheer frustration and anger because I just needed to vent because I'd had a really bad day and I was like, I'm fed up with this. And Michelle was the first person to reach out to me and I was like, oh my gosh, like there's somebody else out there that's got this thing called ARFID. Like, it's actually real. Like, I'm not just making it up. And so, yeah, so just being able to chat to them and obviously find, I think, I feel like we've found a bit of a purpose in life, albeit I'm sure all three of us would probably wish that we didn't have this purpose in our lives, but to help others, because, you know, obviously none of us want our children to have ARFID or any kind of eating disorder, but, you know, that's just life. And if we can help just one person by sharing how we've, you know, done things or our experience or our dark times or the happy times, then, you know, I think it's worth it. And obviously we do get a lot of flack along the way as well. You get people that are not quite so kind, but, you know, you never know, one day you might educate somebody to think a bit differently and just to be a bit kinder and realize that, you know, the world is different and lots of different people, and you know, everyone should just be a little bit kind to each other.
I think that is a beautiful thing to pull from this episode. I think it's one of those things, isn't it, that, you know, nobody wishes they had an eating disorder. Nobody wishes that they had to struggle on through it. And it's a horrible thing to go through. But if you can reframe it and think of the connections that you've made, the resilience that you've shown, the people that you're now helping. I often say to my parents, you know, whilst it's an awful thing to go through, I think it's made us stronger as a family. And I think you do kind of, your priorities shift in life and you learn different things about yourself. So there can be, I guess, you know, a positive reframe of it. I think one question I'd like to ask, if that's okay, is, do you have any thoughts about what the future could look like for Ethel? As in, do you think ARFID will be something that will be there forever, but maybe just managed in a different way? Or what do you think that could look like?
I mean, at the moment, I'm pretty sure that it's something that she's going to struggle with for her entire life in some form or another. I'm hoping as she gets older that the sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, the reasoning, so, you know, sort of trying to say to her that obviously this chicken nugget is the same as, very similar to this one. So I'm hoping as she gets older that we might be able to have a bit more understanding of, okay, I'll give it a go. It does look the same, it does smell the same, I'll try it. Because at the moment we're just in that space of absolutely not, like, I'm not going there, I'm not trying it. So I hope with age that might get a little bit better. We are starting this week alternative provision on every Wednesday morning, and so instead of going to school on a Wednesday morning, she will go to like a therapy session, which is mainly for autistic people, or children, but it's a small group session, and they do have, the people that run it have got experience in feeding difficulties and things like that. So I'm hoping, you know, going to these sessions again might open up her willingness to try, or at least sort of start to smell and touch other things. I think it's just a slow progress. And yeah, with regards to getting older, I also wonder whether the whole sort of peer pressure as such might come into play. So say if she wants to join her friends at a certain place, will she think, oh, I've got to try and eat, you know, some chips or some fries or some, you know, maybe that might be something that has a positive effect rather than a negative effect, peer pressure wise. But yeah, I don't think it's something that's going to just disappear, unfortunately. And yeah,
I suppose maybe over time it's one of those things, you know, I think ARFID very much sits on the border of anxiety and an eating disorder. Mm. And I wonder if the more that those foods are tried or different things are tried, you know, in a very safe and slow way,
yeah,
to almost build up that mindset of, okay, I did that before and that was okay, you know, and gradually build over that period of time, which obviously, you know, is not going to be something that happens overnight. But yeah, it sounds, with it being so sensory, you know, there's, I would say, I'd hope there for her that, you know, that can gradually build over time. And as you say, yeah, you know, if it might be being silly here, but, you know, when mum and dad say something, no child listens to them, but when their friends say something, yeah, it has more merit. So it could be, as you say, if she starts seeing her friends doing it, maybe that reduces the anxiety as well. I suppose it's one of those things that it's very difficult to know what the future could hold, but it sounds like she's got an extremely supportive family behind her.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's one thing. We are determined to try and give her the best. And as any parent, that's all anybody wants is the best for your children, isn't it? So it's... yeah, we'll just have to see how she goes. And I just hope that, you know, life's not too tricky for her with regards to food as she gets older. And yeah, and obviously one of my other worries is that, you know, it gets worse as she gets older. But obviously, you know, you can't think negatively all the time. You've got to try and think positive and, you know, hopefully it's a bridge that we never have to cross, that it gets worse. But yeah, we just have to keep going, keep trying, just keep trying different things. That's all we do, is, you know, do lots of cooking, lots of baking, even though she doesn't eat any of it. You know, she likes to help chop things at the moment. So she'll chop vegetables and salad and things like that. So again, it's all good, because even though she'll really hold it really sort of with like the tiniest little pinch, because she doesn't want any of it to go on her, but it's still, it's progress, and it's every little bit is progress. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, she could be a sous chef in the making. Jo, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. It's been wonderful to chat to you again. So thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's an honour to be able to share, you know, our stories, in the hope that, you know, it might just help one person that's going through, or starting there, of could it be this, could it be that, you know, just to, yeah, if it just helps one person, then we're happy.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jo. It's been lovely to chat to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.